headlines, U.S. and Afghan officials say the U.S. military has left Bagram Air Base near Kabul, which has been the epicenter of the war in Afghanistan for nearly 20 years. The head of a major Iraqi parliamentary coalition says ousting American forces from the country is a national duty.
No pride in genocide!
And protesters topple statues of British queens in Canada amid anger over the discovery of the remains of Indigenous children at former church-run schools. Our top story for this half hour, the Afghan Defense Ministry says U.S. military has officially handed over Bagram Air Base, located near the capital Kabul, to the Afghan Army. The ministry said the Afghan Army will now protect the base and use it for combating terrorism. The base has been the epicenter of U.S.-led war on Afghanistan. Russia has reacted to the news by saying the withdrawal from Afghanistan must not turn into a redeployment of the NATO military infrastructure to Central Asia. The Taliban have welcomed the pullout, saying the full withdrawal of foreign forces would pave the way for Afghans to decide their future. Some 9,600 remaining foreign troops should leave Afghanistan by September 11th. The deadline was set by U.S. President Joe Biden, who seeks to end America's longest war, launched in 2001. The head of Iraq's Al-Fat parliamentary coalition says ousting American forces from the country is a national duty. Hadi Al-Amiri said the prosperity of the country is not possible if the U.S. maintains its military presence in Iraq and continues with implementing Zionist plans. He described the American presence as illegal, saying the government has a duty to throw out the occupiers. Al-Amiri also said that the request for dissolving the popular mobilization units is completely illogical, as the dignity of the country. Anti-American sentiments run high in the Arab countries since U.S. assassination of top Iranian General Qasem Soleimani and Iraqi commander Abu Mahdi al-Muhandas last January. The Iraqi parliament then voted for the withdrawal of American troops from the country. Elsewhere, Canadians gathered to honor the victims and survivors of the country's church-run residential school system, which had brought down the statue of Queen Victoria in Winnipeg.
No pride in genocide!
The crowd chanted slogans against the killing of over 4,000 children as the statue fell outside the provincial legislature. A nearby statue of Queen Elizabeth II was also pulled down. That's on the Canada Day, which is celebrated traditionally as the National Day, but this year's celebrations were muted amid growing anger over the discovery of the remains of hundreds of children in unmarked graves at the sites of former Indigenous schools. Many cities scrapped the events and held vigils and rallies commemorating the country's dark colonial history.
For the first time in decades, Canada Day celebrations have been mostly muted as the country sees old wounds reopened. Various cities scrapped the celebrations following a series of horrific discoveries of unmarked graves around former Catholic schools for Indigenous children. Calls to scale back or cancel celebrations snowballed in May and June when almost 1,000 unmarked graves were found. Another discovery this week, comprising 182 graves of children aged 7 to 15, made matters even worse. The new findings have fueled outrage in the country over a lack of information and accountability regarding violations of Indigenous peoples' rights. The graves remind people of the horrors experienced by thousands of kids that were supposed to be assimilated into the white society in church-run boarding schools. Rallies have been held to honor over 4,000 victims of Canada's infamous residential schools, while Indigenous leaders have been calling for a thorough investigation. Prime Minister Justin Trudeau has described the discoveries as a shameful reminder of systemic racism and urged the Catholic Church to take responsibility. The Roman Catholic Church is yet to issue a formal apology. Activists, however, believe the government is trying to put the onus on the Catholic Church and downplay its central role.
The Canadian government currently is trying to kind of put the onus more on the Catholic Church, on the churches, but obviously the Canadian government is central to this whole horrific history and ongoing colonization.
Indigenous children are not the only victims of racism in Canada. Reports say thousands of Indigenous women and girls have been murdered or gone missing in the country over the past 30 years. The National Inquiry into Missing and Murdered Indigenous Women and Girls says a genocide is being perpetrated. But that's not all. A deadly attack on a Muslim family last month in Ontario and attacks on women wearing hijab in Alberta testified to the fact that racism has deep roots in the Canadian society. A new opinion poll shows some 36% of the Indigenous people and 42% of minorities believe Canada is a racist country. Canada, a country with a dark colonial history, has for decades depicted itself as an outspoken critic of racism and a leading advocate of human rights. But the latest discoveries of Indigenous graves and attacks against Muslims show Canada is yet to take meaningful measures to root out racism in its own society.
India's total deaths from the pandemic have surpassed 400,000 after the country registered more than 850 fatalities in the past 24 hours. India also reported over 46,600 new cases during the same period. The total is now above 30.4 million there. The country witnessed a surge in COVID in April and May. That pushed daily cases there above 400,000 in May. A new variant called Delta, which is highly transmissible, was identified afterwards. The strain has been reported in dozens of other countries, too, causing flare-ups and prompting new curbs. On Friday, South Korea's daily case count topped 800, the highest there in nearly 6 months. Thailand also reported record deaths for a third straight day, with 61 fatalities. Russia has reported 679 more coronavirus deaths in the past 24 hours, setting another record of fatalities for the fourth straight day. This comes as Russia is struggling with the surge in COVID cases that authorities blame on a more contagious Delta variant and a lagging vaccination drive. Despite a rise in cases and deaths, the government says it would not impose a new lockdown. President Vladimir Putin this week, however, urged Russians to get vaccinated. The government has set a goal of fully inoculating 60% of the population by September, but officials now say they would not be able to meet that target. Russia has recorded over 136,000 deaths from the virus and over 5.5 million cases. Well, the defense team of Nigeria's top Shia cleric, Sheikh Zakzaki, has adopted its final address to a Nigerian high court submitting that there's no case against the Muslim cleric. Danjuma Abdullahi has more from the northern Nigerian city of Kaduna.
The leader of the Islamic movement in Nigeria, Sheikh Ibrahim al-Zazaki, is standing trial for allegations of culpable homicide, unlawful assembly, disruption of public peace, among other charges which the Islamic cleric has denied. Rounding up his address to the court, the leader of the defense team explained that the prosecution has not established any case against Sheikh Ibrahim al-Zazaki. He said none of the people accused of the crimes attributed it to his client, and the court has released many of them.
If we feel that no prima facie case has been established against your client, you make a no-case submission, and that is what has happened in this case. So we are waiting for the ruling of the court.
The prosecution has presented a total of 15 witnesses, including Nigerian military officers. But Zazaki's defense team said all the witnesses that were brought before the court confirmed that they did not see Sheikh Zazaki during the attack by the army.
The prosecution called 15 witnesses. We felt that no case has been made to warrant our clients being asked to give evidence. In other words, We address the court to defend that there is nothing to defend on the part of our client.
The trial judge adjourned the case to July 28, when he is expected to deliver his ruling on the no-case submission by Zazaki's defense team. Sheikh Zazaki has been in detention since December 2015 after soldiers of the Nigerian army attacked his home and worship center, killing over 340 of his supporters. Members of the Islamic movement in Nigeria have continued with their protests, demanding the release of Sheikh Ibrahim al-Zazaki and his wife Zinat. They have always insisted that the Islamic cleric is an innocent man who has suffered persecution by the Nigerian government. Benjamin Abdullahi, Kaduna.
In Indian-controlled Kashmir, Srinagar, a young man has returned home after spending 12 years in an Indian jail. The man walked free after all the charges pressed against him were proven to be false. Our correspondent Shanabad reports from Kashmir.
Bashir Ahmed Baba is a free man now. 12 years back, he was detained at the Gujarat state of India for a crime he was unaware of.
I used to work for a German-based NGO. I and my colleague, who was non-Kashmiri, had gone to attend the training workshop on children with disabilities. It was a two-week-long program, but I was detained on the sixth day while my colleague was set free.
Baba was detained under a controversial Unlawful Activities Prevention Act, or UAPA, and was accused of making bombs in soft drink cans.
I was unaware of what I was being questioned about. I even couldn't read the charge sheet because it was in the local language. But one thing I was sure about is that one day I would walk free because I knew I was innocent. But I never knew it would take 12 years to prove it.
Unlawful activity is defined vaguely in the law as any action, whether by an individual or an association, which disclaims, questions, disrupts, or is intended to disrupt the sovereignty and territorial integrity of India, or causes or is intended to cause disaffection against India. According to the National Crime Records Bureau data, there's a rising graph of UAPA cases in Jammu and Kashmir. The UAPA law has come under stern criticism after several activists and journalists in India were booked under it by the Hindu nationalist Narendra Modi-led Bharatiya Janata Party. Scores of Kashmiris are languishing in the jails across India. Providing legal aid and frequent meeting with the prisoners has become a challenge for their families.
In these 12 years, I have seen him once, that only after I sold my gold earring. We were drained financially after his father died of cancer, so going to him was out of our bounds.
Analysts say unlawful detention is a violation of human rights, and the covenants of civil and political rights say such people need to be compensated for unlawful detention, and for those who have falsely implicated them also need to be tried in the name of malicious prosecution.
In India, in case of Muslims in general and Kashmiris in particular, the law enforcing authorities have been given a license to harass, implicate and detain without any cause. That is why we find Muslim population in India is just 15%, whereas 35% prisoners of India are Muslims, and most of them are falsely implicated.
Sheikh added, Kashmir is an exceptional case where New Delhi has placed laws that allow authorities to detain people without any reason. Baba is happy to be back and is rejoicing the reunion with his family members. However, is in a constant dilemma where and how to start fresh. Shahanabad, Indian administered Kashmir.
Diplomatic efforts to save the Iran nuclear deal have intensified over the past months, but several rounds of talks in the Austrian capital have failed to bridge all the differences. In the following report, we'll take a look at what's making the negotiations tougher than expected.
Iran and the remaining parties to the 2015 nuclear deal have held six rounds of talks in Vienna over the past months on a possible return of the United States to the agreement. Negotiators have said progress has been made at the talks, but a deal aimed at reviving the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action remains elusive. The talks have been very tough. What's probably making the negotiations more difficult is the lack of trust caused by America's unilateral withdrawal from the deal in May 2018. By pulling America out of the agreement and reimposing sanctions, former U.S. President Donald Trump violated U.N. Resolution 2231 and defied international calls to remain in the deal. Trump was heavily pushed by anti-Iran lobbies in Washington, like that of Israel, to scrap the deal. But his withdrawal deeply undermined what was left of the U.S. credibility on the world stage. How can the world believe that the U.S. is serious about returning to the JCPOA and fulfilling its obligations after what Trump did? Iran's permanent ambassador to the United Nations, Majid Takhtravanchi, said this week that the U.S. needs to provide a guarantee that it will never unilaterally leave the JCPOA again if it wants to return to the deal.
This was a multilateral, not a bilateral agreement, so the Iranians are absolutely perfectly right to demand some kind of guarantee from the Americans that they will never pull out of the JCPOA again once it's agreed, or if it's agreed, or if it's resurrected, regardless of which administration comes into power.
Observers believe Iran's demand sounds very logical in the light of past experience, because ensuring that JCPOA parties will not unilaterally leave it in the future seems an absolutely necessary step at this point.
And that's a wrap for now. Bye, everybody.
From the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Britain's Met Office climate forecast estimate that without radical action to halt global carbon emissions, Glasgow's maximum summer temperatures will rise by at least 1.1 degrees Celsius by 2030 and by 2.6 degrees Celsius by 2080. We now present you an article authored by Severin Carroll. The piece is titled, Report Says Billions Needed to Protect Glasgow from Climate Effects. The article has been published by the British newspaper The Guardian. Report says nearly 2 million people living in the Greater Glasgow area face severe disruption from climate heating unless billions of pounds are invested in protecting homes, businesses and transport links. A study on the impacts of climate change on the Clyde area estimates about 140,000 of its poorest residents will be the worst affected by increased heat waves, by flash floods and droughts, as they are the least equipped to cope. The report from Climate Ready Clyde, or CRC, a coalition of 15 councils, universities, the NHS and infrastructure bodies, has been published as Glasgow prepares to host the COP26 Global Climate Talks this November. It estimates there is already a funding shortfall of at least £184 million a year to begin retrofitting homes and offices for heat waves, defending roads and rail links against flooding and storms, and planting 18 million trees to absorb higher temperatures and rainfall over coming decades. The report says urgent mobilization of additional finance is crucial, adding that failing to do so will cost the region billions in lost income and emergency spending. James Curran, the coalition's chair and a former chief executive of the Scottish Environment Protection Agency, said a transformational approach was needed. Playing host to COP26 added to the intense sense of urgency in the region. He said climate change exacerbates existing inequalities, and if we don't respond in a coherent and urgent way, then the inequalities that already exist in society will be worsened. James Curran added, some of the people who can least afford it and are least culpable in creating climate change are the ones that are going to suffer more with poor housing. They will be suffering damp in the winter. They'll be suffering excessive heat in the summer. Public transport will be disrupted. The region, which has a population of 1.8 million across an area of 1,292 square miles straddling the River Clyde, include towns such as Hamilton, Paisley, Lanark and Dumbarton, is already one of UK's wettest city regions. The UK's Met Office climate forecasts estimate that without radical action to halt global carbon emissions, Glasgow's maximum summer temperatures will rise by at least 1.1 degrees Celsius by 2030, and by as much as 2.6 degrees Celsius by 2080. By 2050, there is a 50% chance that every year Glasgow will experience summers as hot as the record reached in June of 2018, when the city baked in temperatures of nearly 32 degrees Celsius, buckling rail lines and melting material in the roof of the Glasgow Science Centre. Average rainfall in summers will fall by about 5% under the conservative scenario, but the area will experience flash floods as well. Winter rainfall will increase by at least 5% with a far greater rate of intense storms. Those figures assume the world limits climate heating by 2.9 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial levels by 2080. In a worst-case scenario, where they rise by as much as 4.6 degrees Celsius by 2080, the city's peak summer air temperature could rise by 7 degrees Celsius. The report, titled The Glasgow City Region Adaptation Strategy and Action Plan, says those general changes and an increase in extreme weather events mean up to 100,000 homes and 18,700 businesses in the region would be put at risk of flooding by 2080. Viewed by climate policy experts as one of the most significant to emerge in the United Kingdom, the report identifies 11 priority issues, including some where there is already inadequate investment and planning. They include an early warning system of public climate alerts, covering many more hazards, including surface flooding, heat waves, droughts, wildfires, and landslips. Setting aside vacant land to use as floodplains and blocking new development on flood-prone areas. Paying to adapt people's homes and workplaces to cope with heat waves, flooding and subsidence, particularly for residents in the poorest areas and in high-density housing. Investing in habitat restoration, tree planting and wetlands to strengthen natural protection against flooding and heat waves. A significant increase in spending to protect roads, to protect rail lines and bridges from flooding, erosion and landslips. Ensuring social justice is embedded in the region's climate strategies, so the poorest and the most vulnerable are helped the most. Chris Stark, the chief executive of Climate Change Committee, which advises the British government on climate strategy, said the Clyde Plan should be replicated by other city regions. Chris Stark said. It's a meaningful and pleasant plan. You can imagine what a well-adapted city ready for climate change would look like, and it would be a profoundly positive thing for the region and all the people living in that region. There are criticisms that it avoids challenging the region's heavy reliance on motorways and private car use, and does not propose far greater investment in public transport. The CRC argues their new report focuses on adapting to the impact of climate heating rather than the transport systems. Dr. Richard Dixon, the chief executive of Friends of the Earth Scotland, said failing to tackle car use was a missing piece in the strategy. But, Dr. Dixon added, agreeing such an ambitious plan with a wide range of bodies is no mean feat. It is particularly important for concentrating minds of decision makers that there is a clear and specific price tag put on the necessary work.
The first methodology that the Quran uses is to talk to the emotional side of the human being.
Ya ayyuha alladhina amanu, O you who believe, ista'inu bis-sabri was-salah.
And we have set forth for mankind in this Quran full of examples.
Minbar, a lecture on Islamic issues.
Islam is the way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Assalamu alaikum. We invite you to listen to a short speech by Dr. Shomali.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. La hawla wa la quwwata illa billah al-Ali al-Azim. Zikr is turning with your heart to God. But what does it mean to turn your heart towards God? Does it mean to think of God? Does it mean to remember God, to believe in God? What is to turn towards God with your heart? In order to explain why, what is this, we have to explain what is not dhikr, so it becomes clearer. Imagine shaitan. Shaitan is all the time remembering God, but in a negative way, because he's enemy and he wants to do everything in order to misguide people. So he's remembering all the time God and, you know, worshippers in God, places that belong to, you know, worship, to service, to religion. So he's all the time, you know, an enemy is always thinking about harming. By the way, you must know that Allah is not enemy of shaitan. Shaitan is enemy of human beings, and because of human beings, enemy of God. But Allah is not enemy of shaitan. If in linguistically, sometimes, you know, people use this, they have to be aware that Allah is not enemy of anyone. Enmity is from the other side, but as a, you know, Baba Mufa'ala, maybe if someone, you know, is going to use it, that's different. But shaitan is too little that Allah would, you know, have enmity towards shaitan. And having enmity towards creature, you know, his own creature, doesn't seem that it's possible. Allah is much, much higher than having enmity with anyone. They have enmity with him, yes. He has adov, but Allah is not adov of anyone. Allah wants the best for everyone. It's the other's way. In any case, an enemy is always thinking about harming. Amir al-Mu'mineen, for example, says, "Man nama lam yunam an." Even if you sleep, your enemies are not going to sleep about you. You know, an, it means thinking about harming you, planning. So is this dhikr? Is this zikr? Can we say enemies do zikr? In Arabic language, maybe. You can say الأعداء دائما يذكروننا في مخططاتهم في برامجهم. In Arabic language it makes sense, but in Quranic sense, no. In Quranic sense, dhikr should be positive remembrance. Only mu'mineen among human beings do dhikr of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, not Satan and not bad people who want to harm. If someone develops hatred, for example, towards God and religion, or you know, religious people, and you know, day and night is working about, you know, attacking God and proving that God doesn't exist. Yes, all the time he's busy with this, but we don't call that he is doing dhikr of God. In the Quranic sense, dhikr is to be turning with your heart towards God with positivity, which means you open your heart for God. Not that you close your heart so that God doesn't come in. You know, sometimes I remember someone and I don't want him to come to my home, so I watch the door, you know, lock the door, look, you know, at the door so that he wouldn't come inside my home. Sometimes I want very much someone to come. I open my door and, you know, I say, you know, please come in. أَفَمَنْ شَرَحَ اللَّهُ صَدْرَهُ لِلْإِسْلَامِ فَهُوَ عَلَى نُورٍ مِّنْ رَبِّهِ فَوَيْلٌ لِلْقَاسِيَةِ قُلُوبُهُمْ مِّنْ ذِكْرِ اللَّهِ. Some people, their doors of the hearts are closed. Some people, maybe even they have, you know, sealed it. They have become qasi in their heart. They have sealed the door so that God would not come. They have secret maybe doors for Satan's and their own friends. They love them very much. Or they have, you know, actually put them inside the home, but they don't let light of God come. They don't let Allah. They don't expose their heart to this light to come, and then they reflect. They don't want this. So, dhikr means to turn with your heart towards God, human beings and jinns. To turn with your heart towards God with openness, with joy, with love. Not to just think about God. To be with openness, with joy, with love. This is dhikr. If you do this dhikr in this way, then you would be in harmony with the rest of creation. But your remembrance has more value than many of them, because they didn't have other options. They did it according to their own essence. They are not forced. But it doesn't have that much value that this person's zikr has, because he has decided to open with, of course, grace of God. Allah helps. أَفَمَنْ شَرَحَ اللَّهُ صَدْرَهُ. So even if you open up your, you know, chest and heart to God with the grace of Allah, but you accepted the grace. You didn't say no. You didn't reject. So this zikr has great value. And therefore, imagine if we have a whole plane full of candles all giving light, then we have bigger candles which are mu'mineen who decided to do dhikr of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. And therefore, the light of Allah, which the Quran is, it says it is kamishkatan fiha misbah al misbah fi zujaja. This mishkat is where this mishkat is not put in nature, in environment, although they all reflect God. Even it's not put among angels is fi buyutin adhanallahu an turfa'a wa yuzkara fi hasmu. Allah has put this mishkat in the houses of people who constantly remember him. Nothing will make them forget Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Tijara and bay are things that normally need lots of attention. Even if a person who has no interest in dunya is doing business, has to remember, because otherwise he may, you know, give a mistaken object, or he may, you know, sell more, less. Has to be very careful. People who are after dunya, of course, they are more concerned. But these are the people that even when they are buying, selling, the same if they are driving, if they are shopping, if they are cooking, if they are washing, if they are, you know, visiting the patients, etc., they don't forget God.
You're listening to Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This program entitled Minbar. Our email address is EnglishRadio@irib.ir.
Rahi Kareemun Azim Alimul Halim Hakimul Mateen.
Join us in this journey, IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
The limelight. During the spring of 2020, physicians in New York City, the U.S. epicenter of the pandemic at the time, noticed a considerable number of people hospitalized with COVID-19 had too much sugar in their blood, a condition called hyperglycemia, that is a signature feature of diabetes. According to stem cell biologist Shubing Chen, More surprising was that some patients who did not have diabetes prior to the infection developed new onset diabetes after recovering from COVID-19. We now present you an article written by Bill Sullivan, a journalist and commentator, under the heading, Can COVID-19 Lead to Diabetes? The COVID-19 virus, SARS-CoV-2, is best known for wreaking havoc in the lungs and causing acute respiratory distress. But how and why a COVID-19 patient would suddenly develop a chronic disease like diabetes is a mystery, as is the number of people who must then deal with this complication. A global 2020 analysis led by population health researcher Thirunavukarasu Satish at McMaster University in Canada found that nearly 15% of severe COVID-19 patients also develop diabetes. But he admits this figure is likely to be higher among high-risk individuals, pre-diabetes for example. Research led by endocrinologist Paolo Fiorina at Harvard Medical School and published in 2021 reported that of 551 patients hospitalized for COVID-19 in Italy, nearly half became hyperglycemic. Also, Peter Jackson, a biochemist, estimates as many as 30% of patients with severe COVID-19 may develop diabetes. Intrigued by the startling connection between COVID-19 and diabetes, Xubing Chen and Jackson both launched independent investigations to uncover how SARS-CoV-2 might trigger hyperglycemia. Their findings provide critical insights into the underlying mechanisms by which COVID-19 can lead to the development of new onset diabetes in infected patients. SARS-CoV-2 affects people in very different ways. Many people experience only minor symptoms, but others develop severe life-threatening disease. As the pandemic unfolded, it became apparent that this virus could spread beyond the lungs and damage other critical organs in the body, including the liver, heart, and kidneys. It also became clear that diabetes and obesity were common risk factors for severe COVID-19. In an earlier study, Xubing Chen's group grew various types of tissues in the laboratory and tested which ones were vulnerable to the COVID-19 virus. Xubing Chen says, very surprisingly, we found that beta cells of the pancreas are highly permissive to SARS-CoV-2 infection. The pancreas, which lies behind the stomach, is a complex organ composed of numerous types of cells that assists with digestion. It also contains beta cells that make insulin, the hormone that escorts sugar molecules from the blood into the body's cells where it is used for energy. But just because a virus can infect cells grown in a dish in the laboratory doesn't mean it attacks the body in the same way. To ensure the laboratory observations were a true reflection of what happens in living humans, both the Chen and Jackson teams acquired autopsy samples from patients who succumbed to COVID-19. Both groups detected SARS-CoV-2 in pancreatic beta cells from these deceased patients. But how exactly does a respiratory virus move from the lungs to the pancreas? After patients experience pneumonia, the infection of the lower lung may cause tissue damage that allows the virus to leak from the lung alveoli and into the blood vessels, explains Jackson. Once in circulation, The virus can enter other highly vascularized tissues like the pancreas, brain, and kidney. Others have speculated that the virus could get into the bloodstream by leaking out of the gut, which may occur in patients lacking healthy intestinal bacteria. Both research teams noted that beta cells infected with SARS-CoV-2 stop making insulin. In Peter Jackson's study, the infected beta cells died by apoptosis, a genetically programmed autodestruct sequence initiated by injured cells. Xubin Cheng's group found that infected beta cells underwent a process called transdifferentiation, which means they convert into another type of cell, one that no longer manufactures insulin. It is possible that some infected beta cells undergo transdifferentiation while others self-destruct. In both cases, the end result is the same. When the COVID-19 virus attacks the pancreatic beta cells, insulin production decreases. This can lead to type 1 diabetes, which is usually caused by genetic risk factors that spur on autoimmune reaction that attacks and destroys beta cells. Type 1 diabetes is more commonly seen early in life and requires patients to inject insulin every day, since their body no longer makes the hormone. Type 1 diabetes also involves an environmental trigger, such as an infection, to initiate the autoimmune reaction. In contrast, the far more common type 2 diabetes occurs when the body becomes resistant to the insulin it makes. Type 2 diabetes can be managed with changes in diet and exercise, although sometimes medications that enhance insulin sensitivity are needed. Collectively, 34.2 million Americans have diabetes, according to a 2020 report issued by the Center for Disease Control. The fate of the infected beta cells is important to study further, as there may be a way to prevent their destruction in patients with severe COVID-19. Xubin Chen's team surveyed a large panel of chemicals in hopes of finding one that could prevent the transdifferentiation process. The survey identified a compound called trans-ISRIB and helped beta cells maintain their identity and their ability to produce insulin when infected with SARS-CoV-2. Trans-ISRIB, which stands for Integrated Stress Response Inhibitor, is a compound discovered in 2013 and that is able to prevent a cell's normal response to stress. Such compounds are being explored as potential therapeutics to prevent widespread apoptosis and damage. Peter Jackson's group found that a cellular protein receptor called neuropilin 1 was critical for SARS-CoV-2 to invade beta cells. Blocking this receptor keeps them from being infected. There is also great interest among the broader research community to develop drugs and stop cells from destroying themselves by apoptosis. Experimental compounds called caspase inhibitors, which prevent cell suicide, are being studied by others as potential therapies to ameliorate or prevent severe COVID-19. Unfortunately, caspase inhibitors have not proved a complete success in the clinic despite great promise and interest. Nonetheless, they might work for short-term exposure to limit viral damage, Peter Jackson says. Xubin Chen adds that SARS-CoV-2 is not the only virus that threatens the pancreas. Coxsackie virus B, rotavirus, mumps virus, and cytomegalovirus have all been shown to infect and damage beta cells in the pancreas. Whether they are a direct cause of type 1 diabetes has been controversial. More research is needed to determine if it is possible to neutralize the viral attacks on the pancreas, either by blocking infection or preventing the virus from reaching the organ in the first place. Taliani stresses that these studies further underscore the importance of getting vaccinated for COVID-19. Individuals who contract COVID-19, particularly those with pre-diabetes or other risk factors for diabetes, should let their healthcare providers know if they develop symptoms of hyperglycemia, such as frequent urination, excessive thirst, blurry vision, or unexplained weight loss. These new findings emphasize that there is much to learn about COVID-19 and its after effects. It seems clear that for some unlucky people, defeating the coronavirus is only the beginning. Additional complications may arise depending on which systems in the body have been damaged in the wake of the viral infection.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz for Europe, and 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or BAT 5, and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, P.O. Box 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Televised speech on the eve of the 13th presidential election, June 16th, 2021. People's duty with regard to the elections, participation in the elections, and what kind of participation. In the name of God, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Praise be to God, Lord of the worlds, and peace and greetings upon our Master, Muhammad, and his pure, immaculate household, particularly the remnant of God on earth. May God's peace be upon Ali ibn Musa al-Ridha al-Murtada, God's great guardian in the amount that God knows, eternal peace as eternal as God's kingdom. I congratulate all the dear Iranian nation and all those who are eager to make a pilgrimage to his shrine on this occasion of the celebration of 10 days of Keramat, dignity, and the birth anniversary of Ali ibn Musa al-Ridha, peace be upon him. Unfortunately, we have been deprived of making this pilgrimage for a long time. We are hopeful that God will increase his mercy and favor upon this nation due to the blessing of prayers and intercession of this noble Imam day by day. God willing, the blessings due to the Iranian nation being in the vicinity of this holy grave will increase every day. I'm only going to talk about the elections today. In less than 48 hours, a determining event will take place in the country. That is the presidential election and the Islamic city and village councils elections. Definitely the country's destiny for a period of time in the areas of economy, cultural issues, security, health, and the like is dependent on what you, the people of Iran, will, God willing, do on the Friday. This means that with your participation, with your votes, you in fact will determine the country's destiny in all major issues. The great task that people will do on Friday is primarily to participate in the elections. The second thing is the type of participation and the type of choice. We hope God, the Almighty, will guide our hearts and the hearts of the Iranian nation, so that we may participate in the elections in the best possible way. In one of my recent speeches with the nation of Iran, I mentioned that people's participation has a deep root and a firm intellectual backing supporting it. It is not just a political matter. It has many political benefits. But besides these benefits, and more important than these benefits, is the philosophy behind people's participation in the system of the Islamic Republic.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.